A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the right way to wire a modern home network when you've got fiber coming in from the ISP. The core tension here is whether you should keep the signal in fiber for your internal backbone runs or transition to copper Ethernet early, and what that topology actually looks like when you're running cable between floors and through walls. He's also asking about EMF sensitivity, conduit spacing, and wants us to spec out a couple of real architectures, something with a few access points, a home office, a server, a smart TV, that kind of setup. So we're basically designing a network from the ONT onward.
This is the good stuff. Okay, let's start with the first decision point, literally the first cable. Your ISP brings fiber to the side of the house or the basement, terminates at what they call the ONT, the optical network terminal. That's the box that takes light and turns it into something your network can use. The question is, what comes out of that ONT and where does it go? In most consumer installs, the ONT has a gigabit Ethernet port, and the ISP just plugs in whatever router they're giving you. But the prompt's asking about running to a networking cabinet on another floor or the other end of the house. So now we're talking about a deliberate infrastructure run, not just setting the ISP router on the nearest shelf.
Right, because the ONT might be in the basement, or on an outside wall in the kitchen, and the actual network cabinet is in a closet upstairs or in the home office. That first run could be 50 feet, could be 150 feet. So the question is, do you run that as fiber or as copper?
The answer is almost always fiber. Let me give you the concrete reasons. If you're running single-mode fiber, you can go kilometers. Even multi-mode with OM3 or OM4 will do 100 meters at 40 or 100 gig and 300 meters at 10 gig. Meanwhile, copper Ethernet. Category 6A tops out at 100 meters for 10 gig under ideal conditions. If your ONT is in the basement and your cabinet is in the attic on the far side of the house, you could be pushing that limit before you've even connected your first switch.
The 100 meter spec for copper isn't just the horizontal run, it's the whole channel. Patch cables at both ends included.
So a 90 meter in-wall run with 5 meter patch cables on each end is already at the limit. With fiber, that's just not a constraint in a residential setting. Second reason, electrical isolation. Fiber is glass. It doesn't conduct electricity. If you're running between floors, you're potentially crossing different ground potentials, and copper Ethernet can create ground loops that introduce noise or, in worst cases, damage equipment. Fiber eliminates that entirely.
You're saying the first run, ONT to the main switch location, should be fiber.
And practically speaking, the cleanest way to do this is to place your main router right next to the ONT, have it do the routing and firewall functions, and then run fiber from one of its SFP Plus ports to your core switch in the cabinet. Or, if the ONT has an SFP Plus cage and your ISP allows it, you can bypass their router entirely and run fiber direct to your own router in the cabinet. That's a more advanced setup, but it's increasingly common in prosumer builds.
Let's talk about that. Because increasingly common is doing some work there. ISPs are not universally friendly to the idea of you bypassing their equipment.
It depends on the ISP and the country. AT&T Fiber has historically been notorious for requiring their gateway, though there are workarounds with what people call the dumb switch bypass, or using the WPA supplicant extraction method. Verizon Fios is easier. If you're on an Ethernet handoff from the ONT, you could plug directly into your own router. Some smaller fiber ISPs actively encourage it and will provide you the PPPoE credentials or VLAN tagging information you need. But the trend is toward more openness. The FCC has been pushing for more consumer choice in gateway equipment.
The architecture we're converging on is ONT in the utility area, fiber onto the main cabinet, and then from that cabinet, you're distributing to the rest of the house. Now the prompt asks, for those distribution runs, between switches, out to a home office, to a server, Do you also use fiber, or do you transition to copper Ethernet at that point?
This is where you have to think about what you're actually connecting. Let's break it down by endpoint. A home server. If it's a real server with SFP Plus or SFP 28 ports, or even a desktop with a PCIe network card, absolutely run fiber. You can get a Mellanox ConnectX 425 gig card for $30 or $40 on the used market, and a 25 gig transceiver for another $20. That's a 25 gigabit link for under $60 in optics and NICs.
The switch port to drive it?
That's the real cost. A switch with SFP 28 ports is still several hundred dollars, but prices are dropping. MikroTik and UniFi both have options in the $300 to $500 range for a switch with a couple of 25 gig ports and a bunch of 10 gig. But even if you're not doing 25 gig, 10 gig over fiber is cheap. A used Brocade ICX switch with SFP Plus ports can be had for under $200, and optics are practically free at this point.
Practically free is one of those phrases that means $40 instead of $400. But for a home server doing backups, media serving, maybe some home lab workloads, 10 gig is the sweet spot.
It really is. Now, for the smart TV and the access points, those are almost certainly going to be copper. Smart TVs have gigabit Ethernet ports if you're lucky. Some still ship with 100 megabit ports, which is absurd in 2026, but here we are. Access points, same thing. Most consumer and prosumer APs top out at 2.5 gig on copper. So for those endpoints, you're running Category 6A from the nearest switch, and that's perfectly adequate.
The topology starts to look like fiber backbone between the main cabinet and any satellite switch locations, and then copper for the last 100 feet to individual endpoints.
And I want to be specific about what backbone means here. In a typical two-story house, you might have the main network cabinet in the basement or a ground floor utility room. Then you'd run fiber to a switch in the attic or a closet on the second floor, and that switch feeds the upstairs AP, the home office, maybe a bedroom TV. The fiber run between those two switches is your backbone. Inside each zone, copper handles the last few meters.
The fiber for that backbone run? Are we talking single mode or multi-mode?
I've gone back and forth on this over the years, but my current recommendation for residential is single mode. OS2 fiber with LC-UPC connectors, here's why. Multimode, OM3, OM4, uses cheaper optics, which used to be the argument for it. But the gap has narrowed so much that it barely matters for a home user buying two or four transceivers. Single mode can carry basically any speed you'll ever want. 10 gig today, 100 gig tomorrow, 400 gig in a decade, over the same fiber. Multimode hits distance limits at higher speeds that single mode doesn't. And single mode fiber itself is actually cheaper than multimode per meter. So you buy a pre-terminated OS2 cable in the length you need, pull it through your conduit, and you're future-proofed essentially forever.
Forever is a strong word in networking.
For the usable life of the house is more accurate. The fiber installed in the 1990s for FDDI rings at 100 megabits is still capable of carrying 100 gig today if it's single mode. The optics changed, the fiber didn't.
That's actually a compelling point. Alright, let's get into the physical installation questions. The prompt asks about running cable in the space behind walls, conduit spacing, and EMF sensitivity. This is where people who've never done this before get nervous.
They should be a little nervous because doing it wrong means redoing it. Let's start with the good news. Fiber optic cable is completely immune to electromagnetic interference. You can run it alongside electrical wiring, next to fluorescent ballasts, through the same conduit as power cables if you wanted to. Though you shouldn't, for code reasons, but optically, it wouldn't matter. The signal is light and glass. There's nothing for EMF to couple to.
Fiber's EMF sensitivity is zero. What about copper Ethernet?
Copper Ethernet uses twisted pairs specifically to reject interference. The twists cause external noise to couple equally into both conductors, and the differential receiver cancels it out. In practice, unshielded Category 6A is quite robust, but there are rules. The National Electrical Code says you need at least 2 inches of separation between communications cables and power cables when running parallel. If you're crossing at a right angle, no separation is needed. In residential, this usually isn't hard to achieve. Stud bays are 14.5 inches wide, you put power on one side and data on the other.
If you're running to the same hole in a joist,
drill separate holes. It's not just about interference, it's about heat. Power cables can get warm under load, and bundling them with data cables in a tight space isn't good practice. But honestly, for a typical home with a few dozen feet of parallel runs, the interference risk is low. The bigger issue with copper is something people don't think about, lightning.
Right, because copper is a conductor, and a nearby lightning strike induces current on anything metallic.
That current will happily travel through your Ethernet cables and fry every piece of equipment connected at both ends. Ethernet ports have isolation transformers rated for about 1500 volts, but a nearby strike can induce much more than that. Fiber doesn't have this problem. If you're running a cable to an outbuilding, a detached garage, a shed that's been converted to an office, you should absolutely run fiber, not copper. The ground potential difference alone can cause issues, and the lightning risk makes copper genuinely dangerous in that scenario.
The prompt also mentioned conduit. Let's talk about when you need conduit and when you don't.
In most residential interior walls, you don't need conduit for low-voltage communications cable. You can run plenum-rated or riser-rated cable through walls, floors, and ceilings as long as you follow the local building code. Plenum-rated cable has a jacket that doesn't emit toxic smoke when it burns, which is required if you're running through air handling spaces. Riser-rated is for vertical runs between floors. Most of the time in a home, riser-rated is fine unless you're going through an air return.
Conduit makes it easier to pull new cable later.
That's the real argument for conduit. Not code compliance, but future-proofing. If you install a 1-inch or 1 1/4-inch Smurf tube, the orange flexible conduit, from your basement to your attic, you can pull whatever you want through it 10 years from now. The cost of the conduit itself is negligible. The labor is the same whether you're pulling cable through a wall cavity or through a conduit. So my strong recommendation is, if you're opening walls anyway, put in conduit. Label both ends. Your future self will thank you.
Smurf tube is the technical term.
It's the industry term, I swear. ENT, electrical non-metallic tubing, but everyone calls it Smurf tube because it's blue or orange. The orange is for low voltage. And speaking of conduit, if you're running fiber and copper in the same conduit, there's no issue. The fiber doesn't care. But don't run fiber in the same conduit as power. Not for interference reasons, but because it's against code and it's a safety issue. The power cable's jacket could be damaged, and now your low voltage conduit has line voltage in it.
All right, let's move to the actual architecture. The prompt asked for a couple of different specs. Let's walk through a realistic floor plan and design it.
Let's assume a two-story house, about 2,500 square feet. ONT is in the basement, on the outside wall. We want a network cabinet in a basement utility room, a home office on the first floor, a living room with a smart TV on the first floor, two access points, one per floor, and a home server in the basement. That's a pretty typical prosumer setup.
The ISP is delivering, say, 2 gig symmetric fiber. Common enough now.
So, architecture one, let's call it the pragmatic build. ONT in the basement, right next to it we place the ISP's gateway or our own router. From that router, we run a single OS2 single mode fiber cable to a core switch in the network cabinet, which is also in the basement but maybe 20 feet away on the other side of the room. That switch is a 24-port gigabit PoE switch with 4 SFP plus 10 gig uplinks. Something like the UniFi Pro Max 24 PoE.
The fiber from the router to the switch is carrying?
10 gig, using an SFP plus LR transceiver on each end. That's your trunk. Now, from that core switch, we run Category 6 a copper to the home office. Let's say that's a run of about 50 feet. The office gets a small 8-port switch if there are multiple devices, or just a wall jack if it's a single PC. We also run copper to the smart TV, probably 30 feet. And we run copper to the first floor access point, which is ceiling-mounted in a central hallway.
For the upstairs?
We run a single OS2 fiber from the core switch's second SFP Plus port up to the attic or a second floor closet, where we place a smaller switch, an 8-port PoE switch with 2 SFP Plus uplinks. That satellite switch feeds the second floor AP via copper and any bedrooms that need wired connections. Total fiber runs too. Everything else is copper.
That's clean. What's the cost on something like that?
The core switch, around $400. The satellite switch, maybe $200. Pre-terminated OS2 cables, two of them, custom length, maybe $60 total. 4 SFP plus LR transceivers at about $25 each, so $100. Category 6. A cable, 1,000-foot spool is around $200, and you'll use maybe half of it. Keystone jacks, wall plates, patch panel, another 100. So all in, we're looking at around $1,100 to $1,200 in materials. If you're paying a low-voltage contractor to do the poles, double that for labor. But this is a network that will handle 10 gig internally with a clear upgrade path to 25 or 100 on the backbone.
The alternative architecture. You mentioned there were a couple.
Architecture 2, the all-fiber enthusiast build. This is for someone who wants to eliminate copper from the backbone entirely and run fiber to every fixed location. Same ONT and router setup, but now the core switch is a full SFP plus switch. 16 or 24 SFP plus ports. From that switch, you run individual fiber drops to every room that needs a wired connection. In each room, you terminate the fiber at a small media converter or a switch with an SFP plus uplink, which then provides copper ports for local devices.
That sounds expensive and complicated.
It is, and honestly, it's overkill for almost everyone. The fiber itself isn't the cost driver. OS2 is cheap. It's the optics and the switches. A 16-port SFP plus switch is significantly more expensive than a copper switch with a few SFP plus uplinks. And then you need transceivers for every single drop, 2 per link. For a house with 6 wired locations, that's 12 transceivers. And you still need copper switches at each endpoint to connect actual devices. You're adding a layer of conversion that doesn't buy you anything unless you need 10 gig or higher to every room.
Which almost no one does. The server might benefit from 10 gig, but the smart TV doesn't, the AP doesn't, the printer definitely doesn't.
The printer doesn't even need 100 meg, and yet printer manufacturers still put gigabit ports on them. It's aspirational networking.
I'm putting that on a plaque.
There's a middle ground that's worth mentioning. Architecture 3, which I'd call the hybrid with high-speed zones. You use the pragmatic build as your baseline, but you identify specific locations that justify fiber. The home office, if someone's doing video editing or CAD work off a NAS, gets a fiber drop. The server gets fiber. The living room entertainment center, which is just a TV and a game console, gets copper. The APs get copper. So you might have 3 or 4 fiber runs and 8 to 10 copper runs.
That feels like the sensible default for anyone who's asking this question seriously.
I think it is. And here's a number that might surprise people. A 10 gig fiber link between a workstation and a NAS, using used enterprise cards and transceivers, the client-side cost is under $100. That's the NIC, the transceiver, and the fiber cable. For $100, you can move large files at over a gigabyte per second. That transforms workflows that involve large media files.
The bottleneck at that point is the storage itself.
Yes, and that's the next rabbit hole. You need either a RAID array with enough spindles or NVMe storage to actually saturate a 10 gig link. A single hard drive tops out around 200 megabytes per second, which is well under 2 gig. So you need either multiple drives in a striped array or solid state storage. But that's a storage problem, not a network problem. The network is ready.
Let's talk about the wireless side of this. The prompt mentioned a couple of APs and devices feeding into them. Where do APs fit in this topology?
APs are copper-fed, power over Ethernet, and they should be ceiling-mounted whenever possible. The signal propagates downward and outward from a ceiling. Mounted AP much better than from a shelf or a desk. In a two-story house, one AP per floor, centrally located, is usually sufficient for 2,500 square feet. If you've got a basement, add one there. If you've got a large yard, consider an outdoor-rated AP mounted under the eaves.
The backhaul for these APs? Gigabit copper is fine for most people?
For most people, yes. Wi-Fi 7 can theoretically push multiple gigabits, but real-world throughput even on Wi-Fi 7 with a good client is maybe 2 to 3 gig under ideal conditions. A 2.5 gig PoE port is nice to have, and many Wi-Fi 7 APs now include a 2.5 gig uplink. If your switch supports multi-gig PoE, great. If not, gigabit is still fine for the vast majority of use cases. The people who need more than a gig to their phone are exactly zero people.
I don't know. My phone needs to download operating system updates. I didn't ask for at maximum possible speed.
It will do that at 3 in the morning when you're asleep, so the gig link is plenty. But more seriously, the AP placement matters more than the backhaul speed. A poorly placed AP on a 10 gig backhaul will perform worse than a well-placed AP on a gig backhaul. RF doesn't care about your switch port speed.
There's a metaphor for life in there somewhere. All right, let's get back to the physical layer for a minute. The prompt asked about spacing from other things in a conduit. We touched on power separation, but what about other data cables? If you've got coax, phone lines, speaker wire?
No issue with any of them. Low voltage cables can share conduit and pathways freely. The only thing you need to watch is bend radius. Fiber has a minimum bend radius, typically about 10 times the cable diameter for installation and 15 to 20 times for long term. For a typical 3mm OS2 patch cable, that's about 30mm, just over an inch. You can bend it around a corner of a conduit without a problem. What you can't do is kink it. A sharp kink will crack the glass and the cable is dead. Copper is more forgiving, but you still don't want to kink Category 6A. It can untwist the pairs and degrade performance. Fiber is surprisingly strong in tension. The strength members are aramid yarn, same stuff as Kevlar. But you shouldn't pull fiber by the connector, ever. Use a pulling eye or a pulling grip that attaches to the cable jacket. The general rule is don't exceed 25 pounds of pulling force for a standard indoor fiber cable. For copper, the limit is usually 25 pounds for Category 6A as well, but in practice people pull harder and usually get away with it.
Usually get away with it is the motto of home improvement.
It really is. And I want to mention one more thing about the installation, labeling. Every cable at both ends should be labeled. It doesn't have to be fancy. A Brother P-Touch label with a unique number and a simple spreadsheet that maps number to location. Cable 001, basement ONT, to core switch port 1. Cable 014, core switch port 14 to living room TV. 6 months from now, when something doesn't work, you will not remember which cable is which.
Labeling is the part of networking that separates the professionals from the people who will be crawling through the attic with a toner at 10 p.m. on a Tuesday.
I have been that person. It builds character, but not the kind you want.
Let's shift gears slightly. We've been talking about the physical infrastructure, but there's a logical topology question embedded in the prompt. How do you actually segment this network? VLANs, subnets, that kind of thing.
For a home network of this scale, I recommend at least 3 VLANs. One for your trusted devices, your PC, your server, your phone. One for IoT devices, the smart TV, the thermostat, the smart speakers. And one for guests. The IoT VLAN has no access to your trusted network, and ideally no internet access except to the specific services they need. The guest VLAN is internet only, client isolation enabled, so guests can't see each other.
The access points need to be VLAN aware.
Yes, which is standard on any prosumer AP. You configure multiple SSIDs, each mapped to a different VLAN. Your main SSID goes to the trusted VLAN, a separate IoT SSID goes to the IoT VLAN, and a guest SSID goes to the guest VLAN. The AP tags the traffic, the switch honors the tags, and the router or firewall enforces the rules between subnets.
This is where the choice of router matters. The ISP-provided gateway probably doesn't support VLANs.
Almost certainly not. Which brings us back to the earlier point about using your own router. If you're going to the trouble of running fiber backbones and installing a managed switch, you should also be running a router that gives you actual control. PFSense, OPNSense, a unified dream machine, a MicroTik, even a small FortiGate if you want to go enterprise. Something that does VLANs, firewall rules, maybe intrusion detection. The network infrastructure is only as smart as its least capable component, and the ISP gateway is usually the dumbest box in the chain.
The dumbest box in the chain! Also going on the plaque.
I'm full of quotable moments today. But seriously, if someone follows our fiber backbone recommendation and then plugs everything into an ISP router that can't do VLANs and has a firewall from 2018, they've built a race car and put bicycle tires on it.
To summarize the pragmatic build, fiber from ONT to router, fiber from router to core switch, fiber from core switch to any satellite switches, copper from switches to endpoints, conduit where possible, VLANs for segmentation, own your router.
That's the blueprint, and I want to emphasize something about the fiber choice that people often get wrong. There's a tendency to think, I'll just use Cat 8 for everything, it's rated for 40 gig. Cat 8 is a standard that exists, but it's designed for data centers, specifically for short-reach 25 and 40 gig connections up to 30 meters. It uses different connectors, GG45 or Terra, that are not compatible with standard RJ45. It's not a drop-in replacement for Cat6A in a home, and the cable is thick, stiff, and miserable to work with. It's the wrong tool for residential.
Cat8 is the networking equivalent of buying a Formula One car to commute to the grocery store.
It's technically capable, but impractical, expensive, and you'll hate the experience. The TIA doesn't even recommend Cat8 for residential. Cat6A is the highest they recommend for home use, and honestly, Cat6 is fine for most runs under 55 meters if you're only doing 10 gig.
What about Cat7? I feel like Cat7 is the ghost of networking. It exists in theory, people talk about it, but nobody's actually seen one.
Cat7 is not recognized by the TIA or the IEEE. It's an ISO standard, and it uses different connectors than RJ45, GG45, or Terra, same as Cat8. You can get cables labeled Cat7 with RJ45 ends, but they're not actually Cat7 compliant. They're basically Cat6A with better marketing. It's the monster cable of Ethernet.
The monster cable of Ethernet.
I'm on a roll. But it's a real thing. Companies sell Cat7 cables at a premium, and people buy them thinking they're getting something better when they're actually getting a non-standard cable that performs identically to a good Cat6A.
This is why people get intimidated by networking. The standards are confusing, the marketing is misleading, and the consequences of getting it wrong are invisible until something doesn't work.
Then you're the person in the attic with a toner at 10 p.m., which is why we're having this conversation. The physical layer is the hardest part to change. Switches, routers, APs, those get swapped out every few years. The cable in your walls is there for decades. Getting that right is worth the effort.
Let's talk about one more thing the prompt hinted at. The server location. If you've got a home server, where does it live in this topology? And what does its connectivity look like?
The server should be physically near the core switch if possible. Short patch cables, ideally in the same rack or cabinet. If it's in a different room, that's where a fiber drop makes sense. Put a dual port SFP plus NIC in the server, something like an Intel X520 or a Mellanox ConnectX 4, and run two fiber strands to the core switch. You can do link aggregation if you need more than 10 gig, or use one for storage traffic and one for everything else.
If the server is also doing router duties, running pfSense or opnSense as a VM.
That's a common home lab setup, but it adds complexity. If your router is a VM on your server and the server goes down for maintenance, your entire network goes down, including the Wi-Fi your family is using to stream Netflix. This is known as the honey. Why is the internet down? Failure mode.
A failure mode that is self-correcting. In the sense that you will correct it very quickly under duress.
Under extreme duress, my recommendation is to keep the router as a separate physical device. A small fanless appliance running pfSense or opnSense is a couple $100s and saves you from being the person who broke the internet because you wanted to swap a hard drive.
Spoken like someone who has been that person.
I have no comment.
Alright, so we've got the pragmatic build, the all-fiber enthusiast build, and the hybrid. We've covered conduit, EMF, spacing, bend radius, labeling, and VLANs. Is there anything we're missing?
One thing about power. A network cabinet with a switch, a router, maybe a small UPS, and a server is going to draw a few hundred watts continuously. Make sure the circuit that feeds it can handle the load and put it on a UPS. A small UPS, even a 500 VA unit, will keep your network up through brief power blips and gives you time to shut down gracefully if the power goes out for real. It also conditions the power, which extends the life of your equipment.
The UPS should be in the cabinet, not somewhere else.
Most network cabinets have space at the bottom for a UPS. If you're rack mounting, get a rack mount UPS. If you're using a wall mount cabinet or a structured media enclosure, a small desktop UPS works fine.
What about cooling? A closed cabinet with a switch and a server can get toasty.
Most network switches are rated for operating temperatures up to about 50 Celsius, and they'll throttle or shut down above that. A small cabinet with passive ventilation is usually fine for a switch and a router. If you're putting a server in there, especially one with spinning hard drives, you need active cooling. A couple of quiet USB fans mounted in the cabinet can make a huge difference. Some cabinets have fan mounts built in.
I feel like we've covered the practical engineering. Let's zoom out for a second. The prompt is essentially asking, how do I build a network that won't feel slow in 5 years? What's the short answer?
run single-mode fiber for your backbone. It's the one cable that has consistently outlived every speed upgrade. The fiber I pull today for 10 gig will carry 100 gig or 400 gig with just an optic swap at each end. Category 6A for the last 100 feet to endpoints. Place your APs carefully. Use a real router. That network will feel fast for a decade.
Don't buy Cat 7.
Definitely don't buy Cat 7.
The hierarchy is fiber for distance and future-proofing, copper for convenience and endpoint compatibility, and don't overthink the parts that don't matter. The smart TV does not need a 10-gig link.
The smart TV barely needs a network connection, given how bad the software is on most of them. But that's a different episode.
That's a therapy session.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1860s, naturalists in Patagonia advanced a widely accepted theory that a species of giant slime mold was responsible for the creation of the region's distinctive banded iron formations, proposing that the organism secreted iron-rich waste in rhythmic cycles linked to tidal patterns. The theory held for nearly 40 years before being abandoned.
Patagonia's geology was, for a brief moment, attributed to iron-pooping slime molds with a sense of rhythm.
Tidal rhythm slime. I'm not sure if that's better or worse than the actual explanation.
It's definitely more interesting.
This has been My Weird Prompts. We're at myweirdprompts.com. And if you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show.
We'll be back next week. Until then, label your cables.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.